The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Trevor Sayre. On Monday, November 18th at 4:30 p.m., the Corvallis Urban Renewal Agency will be having a meeting in person and online. The in-person location for the meeting is at the Downtown Fire Station in the Council Chambers, 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard. For the details on how to join the meeting online, see CorvallisOregon.gov. At 6 p.m. on Monday, November 18th, the Corvallis City Council will be having a regular meeting at the Downtown Fire Station in the Council Chambers, 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard. The meeting will also be held virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for more details. On Thursday, November 19th at 3 p.m., there will be a free two-hour online training focused on fair housing laws and responsibilities as they relate to housing discrimination. For details on how to join, see CorvallisOregon.gov. On Wednesday, November 20th at 5 p.m., the Justice, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Advisory Board will meet virtually at 5 p.m. For details on how to join, see CorvallisOregon.gov. On Thursday, November 21st at 4 p.m., the Corvallis City Council will be having a work session that will be held both virtually and in person. The in-person location will be at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. For details on how to join online, see CorvallisOregon.gov. And finally, on Saturday, November 23rd, Ward 5 Councilor Sharlyn Ellis will host Government Comment Corner in the lobby of the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. You can stop by to say hello and ask your questions about local government. Located at the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library here in Corvallis at 645 Northwest Monroe Avenue. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Sayre.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this week's edition of the Corvallis Civics Cafe with your host, Wendy Byrne. In place of the multiple courses from our regular menu, today we are serving a super burrito, a flour tortilla of commentary wrapped around a filling of city politics. Will there be hot sauce on that? You'll have to listen to find out. What happened in our fair city last week? Last week, when I recorded this show, the race for Ward 9 was still too close to call. But, as of November 13th, the victory went to Tony Cadena by fewer than 60 votes. That was the closest race for any ward in our city this year. Speaking of our city council, last week was an off week, which means the council had no meetings. But that does not mean they did not participate in city-related activities. Because on Wednesday, November 13th, there was a meeting of the Budget Commission, and the membership of the Budget Commission includes all 9 members of the city council. At this meeting, they began the process of the transition to a biennial budget. That's right, Corvallis is moving from a once-a-year to an every-two-year budget cycle, a process that the City Council approved earlier this year. Can a City Council that serves two-year terms effectively oversee a two-year budget? Only time will tell. The next meeting of the Budget Commission is their 2025 orientation meeting, scheduled for March 13th. Which kicks off budget season, a series of additional meetings that culminate with the City Council's adoption of the budget in June. And the budget is on my mind, because just recently, the City Council approved a $35 million project to build a new parks maintenance facility, which will be financed via a bond. And next week, the Council continues the process that will result in as much as $200 million in debt. Due to the rundown and too small conditions of many of our city facilities, there is little doubt that we need to invest in new buildings, and the price tag for those improvements will depend on decisions that are being made in the few remaining meetings of this calendar year. There are 6 meetings left in this year for the City Council, 3 Monday night meetings and 3 work sessions. Monday night meetings are for formal votes and formal decisions. Monday night meetings tend to be more heavily attended, in part because they start at 6 p.m., and in part because they are the meetings where the council makes motions, makes decisions, and casts votes. As such, it seems that the Monday night meetings are the place to pay attention, and the place to share your opinion if you are a community member with concerns. But, as a close observer of the council, I can tell you that the place where the sausage is made, where the learning occurs, is at the work sessions. Those meetings are traditionally held on Thursdays from 4 to 6 p.m. At work sessions, the council hears longer reports from staff, and the more casual atmosphere supports conversation and learning. If a person is keen to put ideas in front of the council and staff, doing so during the community comments of a work session is less stressful and could have more impact. Once the council is in their seats on a Monday night, many of them have made their decisions, and testifying before them at that point is too little too late. As an example, this coming Thursday night, November 21st, at their work session, the council is scheduled to discuss the report from the Civic Campus Community Engagement Task Force and also discuss their process on the design alternatives for the Civic Facilities Project. If you are hip to the process and look ahead at the Corvallis City Council 3-month calendar, you will see that on Monday, December 2nd, the council is scheduled to make a decision about which design alternative to choose. What? December 2nd is 11 days from November 21st, and in those 11 days, is there time to make any adjustments to the 4 current design choices? What if, after the discussion on the 21st, members of the council want to see an alternate or additional design? Why is there no time allowed to develop a design that incorporates the community's feedback? I covered that in my last edition of this show. Taking my own advice, I'm learning to deliver my input to the council as early as possible before they are scheduled to make their decisions. I think they are being rushed to make a choice on December 2nd. Here is a shortened version of a letter I wrote to the council, dated Friday, November 15th, in hopes of impacting their decision on December 2nd. Greeting members of the council, mayor, and city staff. I'd like to present to you a fifth option for the city facilities project. There are 5 parts to this option. Number 1. Retain the current city hall for use as meeting rooms. Existing buildings can be made efficient and resilient. The city only recently spent money to make the building level 2 safe. Don't tear it down. Use this as an example of how to optimize the efficiency of an historic building. Set the bar for other cities to follow. Number 2. Decouple the civic administration facility project from the police facility project. Number 3. Plan to build a new civic administration building in the same location as the current municipal court building. Number 4. Plan to build the new police facility on the parking lot to the south of Fire Station Number 1. The city owns the land. The parking lot is large and sparsely used. It is a good location for a police facility. Number 5. If and only if it is determined that a parking structure is needed, build it at the location of the current police department. Do not build it over the current transit center. If a parking structure is built over our current transit center, we will be unable to expand the transit center. And if we cannot expand the current transit center, how can we provide better transit services to the community? In closing, my ideas for option 5 were informed in a large part by the findings and recommendations of the Civic Campus Community Engagement Task Force. Services remain downtown. The civic administration facility and the police facility decouple, and this can add flexibility to the process. Parking is addressed if and when the needs are identified. The current City Hall building is preserved, and we could have a new building that positions Corvallis for the future. I've looked at the 4 options on offer, and I'm not sure why they are the only options. If the public participation was intended to have an impact, the Civic Campus Community Engagement Task Force report and recommendations would have been reviewed well before the 4 options were presented, instead of near the end. Please consider this option 5 as a realistic option. My letter, in full, will be available as part of the public record for the November 21st City Council work session. If you have concerns about the Civic Campus, the City Hall, the process, the budget, acting sooner is better than later. Write them before they meet on December 2nd. Contact information can be found at www.corvallisoregon.gov. In closing, please remember, democracy flounders in darkness. This is a great time to support local news media, such as the Corvallis Gazette-Times, the Corvallis Advocate, and yours truly, KORC. Thanks for joining me here at the Corvallis Civics Cafe. If you have comments or feedback, send me an email at wendy@korcfm.com. And if you have feedback for KORC's news, music, and civics, email us at news@korcfm.com. Until next time, this is Wendy Byrne for KORC.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. On Wednesday, November 20th, at the Corvallis Benton County Public Library along Monroe Street, at 6 p.m., the public is invited to experience a multimedia journey along the Columbia River from source to sea with conservation photographer and author David Moskowitz. The event will be held in the library's main meeting room. The event is co-sponsored by the Corvallis Benton County Public Library and the Spring Creek Project, and Grassroots Books will have copies of the book available at the event. In Big River, Resilience and Renewal in the Columbia Basin, award-winning photographer David Moskowitz and writer Eileen Delahanty Perks are going to illuminate the natural history, hydrogeology, beauty, and human activity on the Columbia River, while also highlighting the challenges facing the region and the people working on sustainable solutions. This event is part of a series of international book events celebrating the book launch of Big River throughout the Pacific Northwest. Big River explores the Columbia River watershed as one living, interdependent entity that embraces a broad cultural and ecological perspective. The culmination of Moskowitz's many years of photographing the river and exploring its watershed, and Eileen's decades of research, Big River seeks a path forward for the Columbia River watershed, balancing the demands around water, salmon, agriculture, energy, and climate with the fundamental need for a sustainable living river. That's November 20th, Wednesday, at the Corvallis Benton County Public Library in the main meeting room. It will be at 6 p.m. You can find out more at bigrivercolumbia.com. You can also learn more about the author, David Moskowitz, at his website, davidmoskowitz.net. That's David, MOSKOWITZ.net. This is KORC News, Music, and Civics.
Hi there, it's Lava Lamp Larry with some interesting news about Oregon. Let's start with some population, shall we? Did you know that more than 130,000 Oregonians moved to other states last year? A little more than half of them to neighboring states like Washington and California. But two of the most popular destinations for Oregon expats are somewhat further afield, Arizona and Texas. Each had more than 10,000 Oregonians move in last year, according to newly released census data. About 6,200 more people moved from Oregon than moved into Oregon last year. Here's the net migration from some of the larger states. California had 11,600 people move to Oregon. Utah had only 4,000 people move to Oregon. Montana, 300 people. Colorado, 2,348 people. Kansas had 1,000 people move to Oregon. And New York, amazingly enough, 2,661 people moved from New York to Oregon. While only a tiny percentage of Oregonians move away each year, about 3% in 2023, the preferences of those who do leave tell us something about what they find appealing. Texas and Arizona both have lots of sun, a lot more than you'll find west of the Cascades. They also have relatively low income taxes, no taxes at all, in Texas. They both have an average sales tax rate of about 8%, while Oregon has no sales tax. And housing cost estimates, which vary considerably within all three states, don't place either state clearly ahead of Oregon. Both Texas and Arizona stand out in the rankings because far more Oregonians moved to those states than made the reverse move. The same goes for neighboring Idaho, one of the most popular states for Oregonians moving elsewhere. Again, the numbers aren't large relative to the state's total populations, but they do give an indication of the relative appeal of each state, at least among the small share of population that's inclining to move. So, for example, Californians had 33,000 people moving to Oregon, but 22,000 moving from Oregon, a net of only about 11,000. Washington had 22,000 people moving to Oregon, while Oregonians moved to Washington 30,000 strong. And on it goes. So Maybe Oregon's not for everyone, but Oregon's population has actually been pretty stagnant last year, with slightly fewer people moving into the state than moving away. That followed 2 years of small population declines that followed the pandemic, a dramatic reversal of rapid migration into the state during much of the 2010s. Because Oregon is the oldest state in the West with a relatively low birth weight, it needs people to move here to keep population steady and to work in the state's offices, factories, and fields. So where are those folks coming from? Again, most people aren't moving far. Most new Oregonians came from Washington and California. Let's move on and talk about semiconductors, very important to the Oregon economy. And there are some dark clouds on the horizon. Oregon's chance for a semiconductor hub has been diminished by a Trump victory and Intel's tension with the Biden administration. According to the Oregonian, Oregon's chance of winning a federally funded semiconductor research hub, one of the state's top economic priorities, appears in jeopardy after President-elect Donald Trump's victory at the ballot box and mounting tension between the Biden administration and Intel. Three people with direct knowledge of discussions between the Commerce Department, Intel, and Oregon say the state's chances of winning a site appear to have diminished considerably over the past week. Oregon continues to press for one of the research hubs, and officials say they remain hopeful. But some people close to the discussions say they feel the Biden administration, due to choose a site before the end of the year, is now focused on other states. The three sources declined to speak on the record because of the sensitivity of the ongoing negotiations. Losing out would be a major setback for one of Oregon's foundational industries and could cost the state nearly $1 billion in federal investment. Coupled with Intel's ongoing struggles, it also would amplify uncertainty around the future of Oregon's semiconductor economy. The Commerce Department awarded two national semiconductor technology sites this fall, one in New York, another in Silicon Valley. Intel, which does its most advanced research in Hillsboro, and Oregon economic development officials remain hopeful of winning the last of the research hubs. That's a packaging and prototyping facility that could be awarded to one state or split between two. It could bring hundreds of millions of dollars in federal spending to Oregon and could anchor the state's semiconductor industry for generations. Quote, "We are clearly the right place if you're serious about national security and maintaining United States leadership in advanced manufacturing," said Duncan Wise, president of the Oregon Business Council, which helped craft the state's semiconductor strategy. He said Oregon has the highest concentration of chip factory workers and designers in the nation and is the logical place for an NSTC site. "We think we'll win on the merits and the relationships," Wise said. "I think we've had great conversations from the Secretary of Commerce and at all levels." U.S. Senator Ron Wyden, a Democrat from Oregon, was a leading advocate for the CHIPS Act in Congress. On Thursday, he said the concentration of semiconductor manufacturing in Oregon still makes it the logical choice for the new site. "Our state remains the best contender for a national semiconductor technology center that can cement our entire country's status as a global leader in domestic semiconductor protection and innovation," Wyden said. The National Semiconductor Technology Centers were authorized by the 2022 CHIPS Act, federal legislation that allocated $52 billion to revive the domestic semiconductor industry. Winning one of the NSTC sites has been a key element of Oregon's strategy for boosting chip manufacturing in the state and is also a top priority for Intel. Well, that's all the biz news from KORC. I'm Lava Lamp Larry.
Like a fly on the wall, at my own funeral, I am free. Like a fly on the wall, at my own funeral, I am free. Like a fly on the wall, at my own funeral, I am free.
Stay tuned for Bicycle Repairman, Episode 2, The Wrath of Chain Lube.
when trouble strikes, at any time, at any place, he is ready to become Bicycle Repairman.
I'm here to tell you about lubricating your chain. Look closely at your bike chain. The goal is to get the chain lube into the tiny gap between the roller and the side plates of each link. Capillary action will distribute the lube inside the chain. First, prop your bike so that you have access to the chain and can move the pedals backward. If you have a kickstand, you'll probably have to put it up. Cinching a strap around one of your brake levers can help keep the bike from rolling while you're working on it. You may want to clean your chain. Some lubes have a high solvent content and can be used to degrease the chain as well as to relubricate it. You can also use a degreaser on a rag. Just protect yourself, wear gloves, and work in a ventilated area. Apply a tiny amount of lube to each link. You can use your right hand to pedal backward as you handle the bottle with your left. A tiny drop in the right spot is much better than excess all over. Many chains have a unique link that can be used to tell when you've gone all the way around. Otherwise, you can just mark the side plate of one of the links. Once you've gotten every link, go back with your rag and wipe off the excess. You can be thorough. The drier you get the outside of the chain, the cleaner it will stay. That's it. Lubing your chain often will make your bike smoother, quieter, and more efficient, and will increase the life of the wearing parts. This has been Bicycle Repairman on KORC.
Bicycle Repairman! How can I ever repay you?
Well, you don't need to come. It's all right. It's all in a day's work for Bicycle Repairman.
The Southtown Art Walk is a grassroots event organized and led by artists in South Corvallis. The first annual Southtown Art Walk took place in 2011 when a small group of artists printed a map and invited family, friends, and the community to visit their studios for holiday shopping. The Southtown Art Walk has become an annual event, and it continues to grow each year as new artists join and existing artists share space at their studios for newcomers. The Southtown Art Walk aims to promote local makers and artists, build connections in the Southtown community, and celebrate shopping locally. It's the first Sunday in December, December 1st, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. There's more information at southtownartwalk.com. This is KORC.
You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics. The following is an excerpt of an article from the Associated Press, dated November 14, 2024. The satirical news publication The Onion won the bidding for Alex Jones's InfoWars at a bankruptcy auction, backed by families of Sandy Hook Elementary shooting victims, whom Jones owes more than $1 billion in defamation judgments for calling the massacre a hoax. The purchase turns over Jones's company, which for decades has peddled in conspiracy and misinformation, to a humor website that plans to relaunch the InfoWars platform in January as a parody. Within hours of the sales announcement Thursday, InfoWars website was down, and Jones was broadcasting from what he said was a new studio location. Quote, "The dissolution of Alex Jones's assets and the death of InfoWars is the justice we have long awaited and fought for," unquote, said Robbie Parker, whose daughter Emily was killed in the 2012 shooting in Connecticut. The Onion acquired the conspiracy theories platform's website, social media accounts, studio in Austin, Texas, trademarks, and video archive for an undisclosed sales price. The satirical outlet, which carries the banner of, quote, "America's finest news source," unquote, on its masthead, was founded in the 1980s and for decades has skewered politics and pop culture, including making Jones a frequent target of mocking articles. Mass shootings in the U.S., such as the Sandy Hook attack, are often followed by The Onion, publishing slightly updated versions of one of its most well-known recurring pieces of satire. Quote, "No way to prevent this, says only nation where this regularly happens," unquote. Next is an excerpt from Snopes.com/factcheck from November 14, 2024. On November 7, 2024, Jones posted a photograph of himself wielding a rifle in front of a large truck on the platform X, formerly Twitter, with the caption following, "I formally accept the offer to serve as President Trump's new press secretary." There was no evidence that Trump had offered Jones the position, and it was possible Jones was joking. The Trump campaign did not answer an emailed question from Snopes about whether Jones was selected for that role. You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics.
During heavy rainfall, localized flooding can cause unexpected hazards. If you see significant floodwaters on the road, do not attempt to drive through, especially if the road is marked closed. Even heavy-duty vehicles can lose traction and begin to float away, which is then a game-changer for safety and, in some cases, your survival. 2 inches or more is all it takes to lift some vehicles to float off the road. Do not drive through floodwaters or closed roads. You can visit tripcheck.com or call 511 to get updates on highway conditions. If your property is flooding and you need to evacuate, remember to unplug all electronics and appliances and turn off your electricity at your circuit box. Also, turn off your water and gas valves. Have an emergency plan and be ready to follow evacuation orders, particularly if you live in a flood zone. Benton County flooding is caused by rivers and streams overflowing during high rain or storm events. Localized flooding can happen as a result of overloaded, blocked, or inadequate stormwater drainage systems that cause sheet flow into streets and low-lying areas, then pooling in yards, sewer backups, and basement or first-floor flooding. Most flooding occurs between November and April, though with a changing climate and often increasingly catastrophic weather events, it's good to always be prepared. You can see your flood hazard zone by doing an internet search for My Flood Hazard Zone and follow the link to the FEMA.gov website, FEMA.gov. You're listening to KORC, Community Radio for Corvallis on 105.9 LPFM or streaming at korcfm.com. This is KORC News, Music, and Civics, a program that you can hear every Sunday from 1 to 2. It's repeated Mondays, 5 to 6 p.m. here on KORC. You can find old archives of the show at our website, korcfm.com. We'll take a quick break from the news and be back with that in just a moment. In the meantime, let's listen to local artist From Another Mista. This is a track called Selfless Love.
Take care of yourself. yourself. Chasing connections, not wealth. Finding oneself is a never-ending journey, ending in a gurney. I'm in no hurry. Negative thoughts can scurry. They don't deter me. I'm the defendant, judge and jury. Staying true. Don't fantasize about what others think of you. Emotions sticky like glue. Overthinking everything you do. Until your wings grew, it's rhythm and flew. Moving in the right direction. It's called progression in the self-love session. And as I continue to grow, I'm learning to love myself and more. Good intentions in tow. So come on, let's go.
You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics. The following is an excerpt from Democracy Now!, which aired on Friday, November 15, 2024. For more information on national and international news, visit democracynow.org.
From Denver, Colorado, and New York, this is Democracy Now!
We can add a few names like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He came in. And he's going to help make America healthy again. And now he's a great guy, and he really means it. He wants to do some things, and we're going to let him go to it.
President-elect Donald Trump has nominated one of the nation's most prominent vaccine skeptics, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., to head the Department of Health and Human Services. The watchdog group Public Citizen calls Kennedy a clear and present danger to the nation's health. Then we look at Trump's pick to head the Department of Defense, Fox News host Pete Hegseth.
Pete Hegseth, in his book, The War on Warriors, outlining a plan for what sounds like total war on the American people here at home, the deployment of the U.S. military domestically in service of his idea of what he calls an American crusade.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I am Amy Goodman. President-elect Trump has picked Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to lead the Health and Human Services Department. Kennedy is the son of the former senator and attorney general Robert F. Kennedy and an environmental lawyer known for his vaccine skepticism. Throughout the COVID-19 pandemic, he encouraged people not to get vaccinated and has instead promoted treatments proven to be ineffective, like hydroxychloroquine. This is RFK Jr. speaking to podcast host Lex Fridman last year.
Can you name any vaccines that you think are good?
I think some of the live virus vaccines are probably averting more problems than they're causing. There's no vaccine that is, safe and effective.
Kennedy last year advanced a racist conspiracy theory that COVID-19 was targeted to certain ethnicities and that Chinese people and Ashkenazi Jews were most immune to the disease. He's promoted baseless conspiracy theories linking environmental chemicals to homosexuality or gender dysphoria. He's also peddled conspiracy theories about water fluoridation and is a supporter of the consumption of raw milk, despite FDA restrictions on its sale due to the threat of harmful bacteria. In other transition news, Trump's tapped North Dakota Republican Governor Doug Burgum as Secretary of the Interior, selecting a major supporter of oil and gas drilling to oversee the bureaucracy tasked with managing U.S. lands and natural resources. In 2017, Burgum ordered the eviction of a resistance camp set up by Lakota water protectors opposing the Dakota Access Pipeline. As governor, Burgum signed a near-total abortion ban into law, a ban on trans girls and women from participating in school sports, and legislation banning the teaching of critical race theory. President-elect Trump has also named three of his personal lawyers for top positions at the Department of Justice, putting them in charge of the agency that carried out criminal investigations into Trump's mishandling of classified documents and his efforts to overthrow the 2020 election. Trump's nominating Todd Blanche as Deputy Attorney General, the Justice Department's second most powerful position. He selected Emile Beauvais to serve as Principal Associate Deputy Attorney General and D. John Sauer as Solicitor General. Meanwhile, Democrats are urging the House Ethics Committee to release their investigation on Matt Gaetz, who just resigned from Congress and was tapped by Trump to be Attorney General. ABC News is reporting a woman testified to the panel she and Gaetz had sex when she was 17 and in high school. Israel's military launched more deadly airstrikes on Beirut's southern suburbs overnight, shortly after issuing new forced evacuation orders. The attacks on the Goberi and Birj al-Barajna neighborhoods leveled entire residential buildings. The districts were some 700,000 people used to live and work are largely empty due to Israel's assault, now in its eighth week. Lebanese officials say the latest Israeli attacks killed at least 37 people, including at least 12 emergency rescue workers killed in a strike on a civil defense center in the city of Baalbek. Meanwhile, Syria's government says at least 15 people were killed and 16 wounded, including children, when Israeli fighter jets bombed the Syrian capital, Damascus, on Thursday. Back in the United States, Rashida Tlaib, the only Palestinian-American member of Congress, has called on Secretary of State Antony Blinken to resign after he refused to hold Israel accountable for failing to allow U.S. aid into Gaza. Humanitarian groups report aid deliveries have fallen to an all-time low since Blinken issued his ultimatum, with just 37 trucks entering Gaza per day in October and an average of 69 trucks per day in early November. Congressmember Tlaib spoke from the House floor Thursday, displaying a photograph of an emaciated Palestinian child.
U.S. law is very clear. No nation blocking U.S. humanitarian assistance can receive U.S. weapons. The Biden administration cannot pick and choose when they comply with our own laws. Children are forced to eat pet food and bug-infested flour. Look at this and do not turn your back on, again, being complicit to this war crime. But Blinken says there's no need to change our own policy.
The New York Times is reporting aides to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu are being investigated for altering official reports of a phone call by a top general who warned of the Hamas attacks on the morning of October 7, 2023. The probe suggests Netanyahu may have been informed of the attack before it happened, which he has denied. Over 1,100 people were killed in the Hamas attacks. In the more than 13 months since, Israel's killed over 43 Palestinians in Gaza, though some estimates put the true death toll at over 300,000. Elon Musk secretly met with Iran's ambassador to the UN in New York Monday to discuss how to defuse tensions between Tehran and the United States. That's according to the New York Times, citing two unnamed Iranian officials. The Trump campaign has refused to comment. Meanwhile, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency visited Tehran Thursday, seeking to restore UN inspectors' access to Iran's nuclear program. Iran cut off access last year and has abandoned limits on its nuclear activities since former President Trump in 2018 unilaterally withdrew the U.S. from the Iran nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA. On Thursday, the head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization said Iran would not succumb to pressure from the second Trump administration.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has been the only party to the nuclear agreement that has unilaterally and with complete goodwill fulfilled all its commitments within the JCPOA for 1.5 years. It has been the other party that has not acted on its commitments, has withdrawn from the pact, and has not allowed others to cooperate, and has also imposed much harsher sanctions against the Iranian people and the Islamic Republic of Iran.
In Sri Lanka, the leftist coalition of the new president, Anura Kumara Dissanayake, has won a landslide victory in snap parliamentary elections. Sri Lanka's first leftist leader, a self-described Marxist, now has the legislative backing to enact his campaign agenda, which focuses on renegotiating a deeply unpopular IMF bailout and corruption. President Biden's in Peru, along with the representatives of 20 other Pacific Rim nations, for his last Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum. Ahead of the official meetings of APEC today, police cracked down on protesters in Lima who called out the repressive government of the interim president, Dina Boluarte, and the exploitation of Peru's resources.
Foreign investment can come as long as they leave progress and benefits for the Peruvian people, because this country is killing us with transnational mining companies and polluting our rivers and burning our jungle. I don't think any country would agree.
President Biden will head to Brazil next for the G20. A concurrent people summit will also take place in Rio, bringing together human rights, indigenous and climate activists. The European Union's fined Facebook's parent company, Meta, over $840 million for violating antitrust laws through its Facebook Marketplace classified ads platform. European regulators say Facebook Marketplace has an unfair advantage over competitors due to the dominance of Facebook's social media network. Norway has formally apologized to indigenous people and other minority groups for its policy of forced assimilation, which for over a century separated families and sought to eliminate native cultures. The Norwegian parliament issued the apology this week to the Sami, Kven, and Forest Finns, and outlined the actions it's taking to provide redress, including protecting minority languages. There are also ongoing disputes over land rights for the Sami, roughly 100,000 of whom live in Norway today. Over 10,000 people in New Zealand are taking part in a march toward the capital, Wellington, to protest legislation that would reinterpret an 1840 treaty, considered New Zealand's founding document, and rolling back longstanding rights for indigenous Maori communities. On Thursday, 22-year-old Maori lawmaker Hana Rahiti Maupi Clark tore up a copy of the proposed bill and was joined by other lawmakers in performing a Maori haka on the parliament floor, suspending the session. This comes just days after New Zealand's Prime Minister, Christopher Luxon, offered an apology to the survivors and families of hundreds of thousands of children and vulnerable adults who were physically, sexually, and psychologically abused in state institutions over the last 70 years. A large proportion of those were from the Maori community. Here in New York, Governor Kathy Hochul's reviving the city's congestion charge program, with the new toll set to go into effect ahead of the inauguration of Donald Trump, who's vowed to kill the plan. The new pricing will start at $9 for most vehicles entering Lower Manhattan during peak traffic, down from the original $15 that was planned before Hochul abruptly called off the program in June. Climate activists like Fridays for Future's Keanu Arpels-Josiah are urging Governor Hochul to put the future of New York's youth ahead of politics.
Listen to our generation and take action on the climate crisis by also signing the Climate Superfund Act, one of the biggest pieces of climate legislation in the country, still awaiting her signature.
And the satirical news outlet, The Onion, has acquired InfoWars, the website founded by the right-wing conspiracy theorist Alex Jones. InfoWars was put up for sale in a bankruptcy auction as part of a $1.4 billion settlement against Jones for defaming the families of children killed in the 2012 Sandy Hook school massacre. The Onion says it had the support of the families and plans to relaunch the website as a parody of right-wing influencers and conspiracy theorists. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency.
That was a segment from Democracy Now!, which aired on Friday, November 15th, 2024. For more information on national and international news, visit democracynow.org. You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics.
This is Wendy Byrne bringing you details about your local government for KORC News, Music, and Civics. KORC strives to provide information from the City Council and other City of Corvallis boards and commissions during our news show. It is important for area residents to be involved in local government, and we understand that busy work and life schedules make that challenging. KORC News, Music, and Civics is here to help. Were you aware that Corvallis City Government follows specific state rules regarding city meetings? This includes providing public notice about meetings, and allowing both live and remote attendance during meetings. Interested people can view meeting materials before or during the meetings, and these materials are archived after each meeting. More information can be found on the city's website at archives.corvallisoregon.gov. To make it easier to keep track of meeting dates and times, you can sign up to receive email notifications about various city meetings. Email notifications include details about the dates, times of the meetings, as well as links to the meeting materials. Sign up for notifications by going to the city website, corvallisoregon.gov. Once you are there, scroll down and find the e-notifications tab on the right-hand side of the page. This will take you to corvallisoregon.gov/subscribe. On this page of the website, you will see a comprehensive list of all the various advisory boards, commissions, task forces, and other meetings of the city that might interest you, and you can subscribe to receive email notifications about any of them. Once subscribed, you will receive email notices before the meetings and links to the recordings of the meetings when they become available. City of Corvallis meeting recordings are archived by chronological order on Vimeo. You can create a Vimeo account for free and use it to view these archives at vimeo.com/cityofcorvallis. For KORC, this has been Wendy Byrne. You can hear KORC News, Music, and Civics every Sunday at 1 p.m., repeated Mondays at 5 p.m., and archived at korcfm.com.
It's time for another KORC Eco Report. The following information was provided by Biology Insights. The Oregon giant earthworm lives in the rich, loamy soils of Oregon's Willamette Valley. These earthworms are often found in deep, well-drained soils that are rich in decaying plant material. The presence of such organic matter is crucial as it serves as their primary food source. The soil composition in these areas typically includes a mix of clay, silt, and sand, which allows for adequate drainage while retaining enough moisture to support the earthworm's needs. The dense canopy of the old-growth forests also plays a role in maintaining soil's moisture levels and creating a stable microhabitat. Human activities such as agriculture and urban development have significantly impacted the distribution of the Oregon giant earthworm. Conversion of forest to farmland and urban areas has led to habitat fragmentation, making it increasingly difficult for these earthworms to find suitable living conditions. Conservation efforts are now focusing on preserving the remaining old-growth forests and restoring degraded habitats to ensure the survival of this unique species. The Oregon giant earthworm exhibits distinct physical traits that make it a fascinating subject for researchers. One of the most striking features is its extraordinary length, which can reach up to 4 feet. This remarkable size sets it apart from most other earthworm species. Its elongated body is composed of numerous segments called annuli, which are clearly visible along its length and contribute to its flexible movement through soil. The skin of the Oregon giant earthworm possesses a translucent, pale pink or purplish hue, allowing a glimpse of its internal organs and the soil it ingests as it burrows. This is not only visually intriguing, but also serves a functional purpose, aiding in the exchange of gases through the skin, a process vital for its respiration. The skin is coated with a thin layer of mucus, which helps in reducing friction as the earthworm moves and also aids in moisture retention, essential for its survival in the subterranean environment. Its sensory organs are adapted to its underground lifestyle. Although lacking eyes, its specialized cells, known as photoreceptors, detect changes in light intensity, helping it to avoid surface exposure where it might be more vulnerable to predators. Additionally, its body is equipped with chemoreceptors and mechanoreceptors, enabling it to sense chemical changes in the soil and physical vibrations, respectively. These sensory adaptations are crucial for locating food sources and avoiding potential threats. The earthworm's muscular system is highly developed, allowing it to navigate through the dense, compact soils of its habitat. It possesses both longitudinal and circular muscles, which work in a coordinated manner to produce the characteristic undulating movement of earthworms. This efficient locomotion mechanism is crucial for its role in soil aeration and organic matter decomposition, processes that significantly contribute to soil health. Like many earthworms, the Oregon giant earthworm is hermaphroditic, meaning each individual possesses both male and female reproductive organs. This dual capability maximizes their reproductive potential, making it possible for any two mature individuals to mate, a significant advantage in the often isolated underground environment. Mating typically occurs in the moist soil during the warmer months when conditions are optimal. The process begins with two earthworms aligning themselves ventrally, exchanging sperm through a mucus sheath that envelops both partners. This mutual exchange of sperm ensures genetic diversity, which is crucial for the health and the resilience of the population. They are stored in structures called spermatheciae, allowing for delayed fertilization, which can be timed to coincide with favorable environmental conditions. Following mating, the earthworm will produce a cocoon, a small lemon-shaped structure where fertilization and early development occur. The cocoon is secreted by the clitellum, a glandular section of the earthworm's body, and is deposited in the soil. Inside the cocoon, fertilized eggs undergo embryonic development, protected from desiccation and predators by the tough outer layer. The number of eggs per cocoon can vary, but typically only a few juvenile earthworms emerge, each fully formed and ready to begin life in the soil. Juveniles must rapidly gain size and strength to navigate through their environment and reach reproductive maturity. This growth period can span several months, depending on soil conditions and food availability. As a detritivore, this earthworm primarily consumes decaying organic matter, particularly leaf litter and other plant debris that accumulate on the forest floor. Using its muscular, extendable pharynx, the earthworm draws in organic material, where it's then transported to its mouth through rhythmic contractions. Once the organic material enters the mouth, it travels through the digestive tract, where a series of specialized structures work to extract nutrients. The food first passes through the esophagus and then into the crop, a storage chamber where it's temporarily held. From the crop, it moves to the gizzard, a muscular organ that grinds the food into finer particles using small ingested stones. This mechanical digestion is crucial for breaking down the tough, fibrous plant material that constitutes the earthworm's diet. Chemical digestion occurs as the finely ground plant material progresses into the intestine. Here, enzymes and symbiotic microorganisms break down the organic matter further, allowing for the efficient absorption of nutrients. These microorganisms play a vital role by decomposing complex compounds that the earthworm's own enzymes cannot process. The symbiotic relationship between the earthworm and these microbes enhances digestive efficiency and contributes to the overall fertility of the soil. The Oregon giant earthworm plays an indispensable role in soil aeration and nutrient cycling, processes that are fundamental to maintaining healthy ecosystems. As these worms burrow through the soil, they create extensive networks of tunnels that facilitate the movement of air and water. This aeration process is crucial for the health of plant roots as it ensures that they receive adequate oxygen and moisture, which are essential for growth and nutrient uptake. In addition to aeration, the earthworm's feeding and digestive activities significantly contribute to nutrient cycling. The ingestion and breakdown of organic matter result in the production of nutrient-rich castings, which are excreted back into the soil. These castings are highly beneficial as they contain concentrated levels of essential nutrients such as nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. The presence of these nutrients enhances soil fertility, promoting robust plant growth and supporting a diverse array of soil organisms. The continuous turnover of organic material and the subsequent release of nutrients creates a dynamic and balanced ecosystem. Despite their ecological importance, Oregon giant earthworms face numerous threats from both natural predators and human activities. Understanding these challenges is essential for developing effective conservation strategies. Predators of the Oregon giant earthworm include various birds, mammals, and even other invertebrates. Robins and thrushes are particularly adept at locating and extracting earthworms from the soil. Mammals like moles and shrews also pose a threat as they actively hunt earthworms. These natural predators play a role in controlling earthworm populations, but their impact is generally balanced by the earthworm's reproductive capabilities. Human activities pose a more significant threat to the giant earthworm. Habitat destruction due to agriculture, urban development, and deforestation has led to substantial declines in their populations. The fragmentation of old-growth trees reduces the availability of suitable habitats, making it increasingly difficult for these earthworms to survive. Additionally, the introduction of non-native species, such as invasive earthworms and predatory invertebrates, further exacerbates the challenges faced by the Oregon giant earthworm.
When your car is making a strange noise, no matter what it is, you can't just pretend it's not happening.
That's an interesting sound.
It's like your mental health. If you're struggling and feeling overwhelmed, it's important to do something about it. It can be as simple as talking to someone in your community or just taking a deep, calming breath when you need it. Nice. For mental health resources, check out loveyourmindtoday.org. At loveyourmindtoday.org, you'll find information that may help you get through a tough time. Things like tips for dealing with stress, how to navigate difficulties like financial worries, anger, substance use, and more. You can also find real stories of how people navigated their own mental health challenges. Because once you start to address the problem, you can go so much further. Visit loveyourmindtoday.org. That's loveyourmindtoday.org. Brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ad Council.